Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For Westerners, Persia evokes images of the Arabian Nights and flying carpets, but until 1935, Persia was the official name for the country of Iran. Today on All Sides, a look at the important cultural and artistic heritage of Persia and how it reflects the modern country of Iran. Later this hour, we'll talk to a professor of Persian literature. We'll also hear an update on the current geopolitical situation of Iran with a foreign policy expert. This weekend, the Carpe Diem String Quartet presents a Persian musical feast. It's a three-day mini-festival celebrating the culture, literature, music, and food of the Persian people. We'll post a link for more information on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. Joining us now is Chaz Weatherby. He's the first violinist of the Carpe Diem String Quartet. Welcome, Chaz.
Good morning, Ann.
Also joining us is Dariush Sagafi. He's a musician who plays the classical Persian instrument called the santur. He will be performing at the Persian Musical Feast this weekend with the Carpe Diem String Quartet. Welcome, Dariush.
Thanks very much.
And the quartet and Dariush Sagafi will be performing live for us in a few moments. First of all, Chaz, thematic concerts are one way that the quartet is working to change the chamber music experience. And I was wondering, why a festival of Persian culture this weekend? What inspired it?
This was inspired by our desire to learn more about this incredible, rich, and very, very ancient culture and the music that goes along with it. It's fantastic, wonderful music. It's also music that we don't know very well in America and in the West, I think. And the instruments, such as the santur that Dr. Sagafi will be playing today, these are exotic sounds to our ears. Even the method of playing the music and the types of scales they use are different than what we're accustomed to in the West. So it's really just been a wonderful exploration.
A nice challenge. Well, let's listen to an excerpt of a piece from the Kabiri Quartet, the new work by Columbus composer Richard Jordan Smoot that will be premiered at a Persian musical feast this weekend. For more information, once again, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This work was written for the Carpe Diem String Quartet and incorporates many elements of Persian folk music. The quartet is named after Humen Kabiri, an Iranian-born radiologist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You were just listening to an excerpt from the Kabiri Quartet. It's a new work by Columbus composer Richard Jordan Smoot. It will be premiered at a Persian musical feast this weekend. We're talking about Persia and its modern counterpart, Iran. The work was written for the Carpe Diem String Quartet It is named after Hooman Kabiri, an Iranian-born radiologist at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Once again, the members of the Carpe Diem String Quartet performing for us today are Chaz Weatherby on violin and John Ewing on violin and Corinne Fujiwara on viola and Carol O on cello. So, Corinne, tell me about the process of commissioning something like this and asking somebody to write something for an event like this.
Well, it it involves a meeting of the minds, actually, to try to, first of all, figure out what kind of a piece. And obviously, we had the Persian theme in mind, and Mr. Kabiri and Richard Smoot had such a strong relationship, a teacher-student, both ways. I think Mr. Kabiri was a guitar student of Richard Jordan Smoot, and in turn, in the process of their long teacher-student relationship, Richard learned a lot about the Persian culture from Mr. Kabiri. And so the idea was born that the piece that Richard would write would be a tribute to that and kind of a journey through his learning about the Persian culture. And so to commission a piece like that, we talk back and forth with the composer and find a way to program it, and here we have the festival.
It's absolutely beautiful, by the way. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the festival. Can you give me a thumbnail of what we're going to see and hear and taste at the festival?
Well, we have three nights of concerts, Friday and Saturday nights, and actually Sunday at 4 p.m. And the feature of the concerts is all of this wonderful music, these works by Reza Vali, the Iranian composer, the new piece that's being premiered by Richard Smoot, and also our santur player, Dr. Sagafi, is going to also do a traditional kind of improvisation that you're going to do on the santur?
Yes, I do improvisation for 15, 20 minutes before the choreography, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and then surrounding the concerts, we have ancillary events. We have a lecture, and we have a display of rugs. We have some folk musicians who will be there singing and playing some traditional Persian music. We have food. We have ice cream. It's just going to be fantastic.
You got to have ice cream,
I'm
right?
I'm thinking about the ice cream, clearly.
Right, we're going to have Dick Davis, a professor of Persian and chair of the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at Ohio State University. He's going to join us in the next segment, but he will be there will be at least one lecture or more with him?
I think his featured lecture is on Saturday afternoon.
Okay. And once again, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides if you want to learn more about a Persian musical feast. It's a three-day mini festival celebrating the culture. Tell me what the process by which you were inspired to do this now, but tell us about some other similar thematic events that you've presented.
We began our year with a concert that featured music from the Far East, or music that was inspired by the Far East. So music from China and then other Western composers who were influenced by that music. But in addition to that, we had a presentation of tea by the Zencha Tea Salon that's here in Columbus. And they talked about tea and its significance. There was a demonstration of the tea ceremony that was accompanied by music that we performed. And then in addition to that, we also had a demonstration of a Tai Chi martial arts master form, the Tai Chi form with sword and with spear. And so this was, an encompassing of some of the arts, at least, of China and the Far East and exploring the connection to music therein.
Dariush, could you talk a little bit about the cultural significance of the santur and how far it goes back and where it came from?
Santur is going back as far as several thousand years, and most likely is originated from the Persia, that area. We see it in the carving of Assyrian, carving many years ago. So it's a kind of popular instrument in Iran, and the number of the players are getting more and more these days.
So let's end this segment with an excerpt from a piece by Iranian-born composer Reza Vali. You mentioned him earlier. It's called Calligraphy No. 4. It's a work for string quartet and the santur. The composition is based on Persian traditional music, and it was dedicated to santur master Darius Sagafi when the work premiered in 2002. The members, once again, of the Carpe Diem String Quartet performing for us today, and thanks again for joining us, are Chaz Weatherby on violin, John Ewing on violin, Corinne Fujiwara on viola, and Carol Oh on cello. Darius Sagafi is a musician who plays the classical Persian instrument called the santur. He'll also be performing at the Persian Musical Feast this weekend with Carpe Diem String Quartet.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life here with very exciting news, which is we're going to do an episode of our show on stage and beam it live to movie theaters all across the country. It includes Mike Birbiglia.
I got to get me some of that.
David Rakoff.
I won't truly love television until I love myself.
OK Go. And more Thursday, May 10th. Find a theater near you. Go to thisamericanlife.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City Baker's Dozen. You can bid now on 13 of the most sought-after Chefs in the City silent auction packages, even if you don't have a ticket to the event. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all 13 items up for bid, including Dinner for Four at MasterChef Hubert Keller's world-renowned restaurant, Fleur de Lis in San Francisco, or a private five-course dinner at Ella in New Albany. or a wine tasting and hors d'oeuvre reception at the refectory, 420, and much more. But hurry, the bidding closes today at 1 p.m. Visit WOSU.org/chefs.
Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance at 481-8888.
81 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, warming up to a high of 87. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 64 degrees, and about a 40% chance of rain for Friday, otherwise some sunshine and a high of 81. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This weekend, the Carpe Diem String Quartet presents a Persian musical feast. It's a three-day mini-festival celebrating the culture, literature, music, and food of the Persian people. We'll post a link for more information on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're presenting a mini Persian festival today. We just heard the artistry of the Carpe Diem String Quartet, which will be performing three concerts at the festival. Joining us now is Dick Davis. He's a professor of Persian and chair of the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at OSU. As author, translator, or editor, he has produced more than 20 books, including a translation of the Shahnameh, the Persian Book of Kings, named Book of the Year by the Washington Post, and his most recent book of poetry, A Trick of Sunlight. You'll be presenting, Dick Davis. Welcome to the show, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You'll be presenting a lecture at the festival this weekend. When you get a chance to talk to the public, kind of the general public, instead of scholars and people who are studying what you study, what do you want them to know about Persian culture?
It's a hard question. What I really want them to understand, particularly Western audiences, is how rich and complicated and old and various Persian literature in particular is, because that's what I study and I'm most interested in. But the whole culture, it has a wonderful tradition of painting. And as we've heard, it has a wonderful tradition of music too. It has beautiful architecture. It has gorgeous gardens. It is a fantastic culture. The literature itself, my speciality is medieval literature. And the thing that struck me when I first began to study it is how vast it is. I mean, in the West, we're used to the medieval literature, say, of England, my country. We can only probably name one major English medieval poet, Chaucer. He's a great poet, no doubt. And there are other poets too, minor. But Persian medieval literature, there are at least 10 people of the stature of Chaucer, and there are many, many others too. It's a marvelously complex and rich literature, and there's a great deal of it. And one of the reasons I got into all this is that I realized so little of it is known in the West, so little of it is translated. And I thought, if I can, as it were, get myself into a position where I can get hold of this literature and understand it, I can bring some of it across, I can translate, I can make myself a kind of conduit, a way for people to see this culture that I fell in love with 30 years ago and I'm still in love with.
You mentioned particularly the Western people, how interested you are in sharing it with them. But I was wondering, because of what's happened in Iran since 1979 particularly, how much the youth growing up there since then really know about it anymore? Do you have a sense about that? I know you have. You left, you lived there for about 8 years.
That's right. Yeah.
And you left before the revolution, but do you have any sense about what people know there?
I left just about as the revolution got going. I mean, I was there during the early riots, the street demonstrations. There was a kind of, there were some clashes between the military and the demonstrators. I was there during that, but I left before the Shah left and before Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran. I think there's a situation which is not an uncommon one in Iranian history, which is that there is a kind of official literature which is approved of by the government, and then there is a kind of unofficial literature which young people often read and recommend to one another, and so there's a kind of underground literary scene, as well as the scene that's countenanced and approved of on the surface. This underground scene, of course, it includes new writers, but it also includes a lot of classic writers who've fallen out of favour. A great deal of medieval Persian literature, and the medieval literature, everyone agrees, is the great literature of Iran. A great deal of medieval Persian literature is very subversive of the values of the present government in Iran. And although they can't really ban the Shahnameh, it's such an iconic, fundamental literary work. It's like Shakespeare in English. You can't say no Shakespeare. You can't say no Shahnameh. It's not. There are, in fact, Ayatollahs who have spoken against it and said it should be banned. But people don't take that really seriously. But it's not encouraged. Whereas the Shahnameh is very popular among young people. Even more popular are the poets who recommend love and music and wine and happiness rather than prayers and revolution and hating your neighbours. Those poets, the great poet Hafez, who is a very rebellious poet in many ways, and a poet who celebrates pleasure, both spiritual pleasure and physical pleasure. Hafez is immensely popular in Iran at the moment because he's seen as a kind of alternative to this very repressive, rather dour, if I can use a word that doesn't really fit, but you'll see what I mean, this rather Puritan culture which pushes down on what all young people want, which is a good time and a chance to be free and to develop in the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dick Davis. He's chair of the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at The Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You spent 4 years translating the Persian epic Vis and Raman, 500 pages of rhymed couplets. I read about 20 of them last night. Your translation was published a few years ago. You said in a foreword to the book that the 11th century was a period when a number of Persian authors were interested in writing versions of stories from pre-Islamic Iran.
Yeah.
What do we learn about Persian history and pre-Islamic Iran from those?
Vis and Ramin is the most marvelous work. It's really the first great Persian romance. It was written in the 11th century, about 1050, just a little while after that epic I mentioned, the Shahnameh, which was written about 40 years before. Those two books together, the stories that they tell are stories from before Iran became an Islamic country. And in Vis and Ramin especially, you can see an enormous nostalgia for that world. It's not that they are anti-Islamic or anti-Arab. It's just they feel that there is something which is very sweet, very noble, very kind of intimate with the Persian soul, which has been pushed underground. And it all wells up in Vis and Ramin, which is a kind of celebration it's a celebration of young love. It's the typical romance story. The young lovers are separated. The young woman has to marry a man much older than herself. And the young man tries to steal her away and so on and so forth. And one of the great things about this romance is that it ends happily, which is such a nice relief after most romances one reads where the lovers end up dead. These lovers end up married and they become king and queen. It's a very satisfactory end, as it were. And it is the most beautiful poem. It's an absolutely gorgeous poem. What these poems say is, both the Shahnameh and Vis and Ramin. The Shahnameh is about heroes and kings. It's not about private love and affection. But both poems in different ways say, this was our world and it's gone. We don't live in that world anymore. We don't live in that world where really we could make decisions as to what we are for ourselves, which is what Vis and Ramin is about. These young lovers make their own decisions. They rebel against their parents and so on and so forth. And they win out. They win, which is what's so comforting about the poem. And in the Shahnameh, it's the great Persian heroes who are celebrated. Both the poems are kind of acts of conservation and acts of nostalgia. They don't actually give us probably a real picture of what pre-Islamic Iran was like, because they're seen through rose-tinted spectacles. The authors are not living in pre-Islamic Iran, they're living in Islamic Iran, and they're not anti-Muslim, not at all. Neither Ferdowsi nor Gorgani, the author of Vis and Ramin, they're not anti-Muslim. But they're just saying, there was another kind of life here, and it was wonderful, and I will show you what it was like in my book. So that's the feeling you get from these books.
What do we know about the writers?
We don't know very much about either of them. There are a lot of legends about Ferdowsi, the author of the epic, but almost all of them are almost certainly untrue. None of them appear in writing until about 150, 200 years after his death. And of course, in 200 years, an awful lot of legends can grow up. We know a little bit about Ferdowsi from what he says about himself in his poem, but in the Shahnameh. But even then, you have to be careful because poets tend to say the same kinds of things in poems. Because one reason is they're looking for patronage, so they always say, "I have no money," and they say, "I'm old and sick, and somebody should look after me." I mean, all medieval Persian poets say that kind of thing because they want somebody to come along and give them a purse of gold and say, "Right, go and write your poems." So there's some of that in Ferdowsi's poem. What we do know about Ferdowsi is that he presented his poem to the king of the time, who was not a Persian. He was a conqueror from Afghanistan. He was actually Central Asian Turkish ethnically. Ferdowsi presented his poem to this man, and the man rejected it and was not interested. And at the end of his poem, Ferdowsi is very angry, and he says, "I have spent my whole life writing this, and I've just been cast off and thrown away, and there's a lot of bitterness at the end of the poem." But he also says, "Although I've been treated so badly, my name will live forever because I know I've done something really good." And he's right. His name has and will live forever because the Shahnameh is, I mean, it's comparable to Homer or to Shakespeare. It's an absolutely fantastic work. Gorgani, the author of the romance, we know almost nothing about him. All we know is that it was written in Isfahan, a city in southern Iran, between 1050 and 1055, because he dedicates it to the ruler of Isfahan, and that guy that he dedicates it to was ruling in Isfahan at that time. So, and that's really the only thing we know about Gorgani.
As I kind of parachuted into each of those of your translations, I was struck by how easy it was for me to understand. I mean, I studied Chaucer in college, and it was easier for me to understand your translations of these Persian works than Chaucer. And I wondered, how do you make those translations authentic and true and still create a modern syntax that anyone, you know, people can enjoy and understand?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is practice.
Yeah, I know you're the best. I've read many plays. You are, by the way, people. He's the best, Dick Davis.
No, I have been doing it for a long time. But what you try and do is, I think what any translator tries to do, you try to do two things simultaneously, which are almost contradictory. One is you try to show the Western audience how different this is, how other it is, how strange it is, how not like us it is. But whilst you're doing that, at the same time, how special it is, how, you know, why it's worth our attention, why it's not like a story we might read from our own culture. But at the same time as you're doing that, in order to get people to read it, in order to bring it home to people, you have to underline, you have to emphasize, you have to bring it to people's strong attention that these are people like us. They feel the things we feel. They want the things we feel. They fall in love in the way that we fall in love. They want revenge in the way that we want revenge. They feel bad about wanting revenge in the way that we feel bad about wanting revenge, and so on and so forth. So you have to both establish the difference, the strangeness, the exoticism, if you like. I don't think it's bad to make something from a foreign culture a little exotic, because it is exotic. But at the same time, you have to bring across the human dimension, which unites us, which brings cultures together, which says, in fact, you know, we all psychologically, spiritually exist in a continuum. Their feelings are our feelings, and our feelings are their feelings. I felt this very much in Vis and Ramin. The psychological strength of Gorgani's writing, particularly of the heroine Vis, is extraordinarily convincing and very beautiful. It's in verse, but it's like a modern novel. And Vis is the important character. This woman is at the center of it. Ramin is there, but he's there as her lover. But it's about Vis, this princess who is betrayed into a bad marriage and then tries to find a way to be with the person she really loves. And the kind of regret and worry and longing and despair which you get in Vis, they're instantly recognizable to us over 1,000 years from a completely different culture. They're the kinds of things that young people feel in our culture, too.
Vis and Ramin have been compared to Tristan and Isolde. Made me think, to what extent do we know the influence of pre-Islamic Persian culture on the rest of the world, especially Europe.
This
which was the rest of the world.
Sure, yeah. This is very contentious among scholars. Some people say there's no influence at all. Some people say there's a lot of influence. In the specific instance of Vis and Ramin, and this is my opinion, I emphasize, many scholars disagree. In fact, I'm going to go to a conference in June, which is about exactly this, with scholars on both sides. I feel in the case of Vis and Ramin, if you put Vis and Ramin next to the Tristan story, it seems to me undeniable that there is a direct link. The stories are so similar. The only really big difference is the end. Tristan and Isolde, of course, ends in tragedy and death. Vis and Ramin ends happily. But there are so many details in the story that are the same. The psychological feel is the same. The kind of suffering of the heroine, the attempts of the hero to make things work. I mean, many people say that, well, you know, you find this in lots of love stories all over the world, but you don't find this set of anecdotes, this set of motifs, this set of happenings in the same order about the same characters laid out with the same kind of rhetoric, which you do between Vis and Ramin and Tristan and Isolde. And I'm convinced. I'm not saying it's the only source for Tristan and Isolde. I think what happened was it got to Europe, probably when the first Crusaders came back from Europe, which was about 40 years after Grogani wrote his poem. The first Crusaders came back to Europe. I think they brought the story back, probably. And it probably melded on to a story that was already in Europe. But I think it took over the European story, whatever it was, because Tristan is so like Vis in so many ways. So I'm convinced that there's a connection. Many scholars disagree.
And therefore a stronger influence on European culture.
Yeah, I mean, if this is true, if it's true that there is a connection, and as I say, I'm convinced there is, it means that, I mean, Tristan and Isolde is the first great love story in European culture. And if Tristan and Isolde, in fact, owes much of its origin to a Persian love story, it means that everything that comes after Tristan and Isolde, like Paolo and Francesca in Dante, or Romeo and Juliet in Shakespeare, or the lovers in Jane Austen come for that, you can trace them back to Vis and Ramin in Persia, which to me is an extraordinary idea, an extraordinary story. But I think it's actually true.
You taught at the University of Tehran starting in 1970.
That's right. Yes.
And lived there for 8 years, leaving before, as we mentioned earlier, the revolution in 1979. I read that experience changed your life. What was Iran like back then? How did it change your life? Obviously, you married an Iranian, so
sure. Yes.
That's one way.
Well, it changed my life. I went there at that time when one's ready for one's life to be changed, as it were. I was 25 when I went, and I was 33 when I left. I had thought of myself as somebody who was going to get into medieval English and maybe European literature. I had a friend who was working in Iran as an archaeologist, and he said, why don't you come out and we'll teach English together and we'll share an apartment and have a good time and for a year, let's do that. And I said, okay. And so I went and I just fell in love. I fell in love multiply. I fell in love with the person who's now my wife. I fell in love with the country and its various cultures. It's difficult to say Iranian culture because there are so many cultures there. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to do medieval stuff, I'm going to do medieval Persian stuff. And I started to read medieval Persian with a tutor. And then when we went back to England, I looked for a university that would accept me as a candidate in medieval Persian. It was a kind of golden period for me. I found myself, I found what I wanted to do with my kind of professional life. I thought, right, I'm going to give myself to this wonderful treasure trove of literature that I've found that the West doesn't seem to know very much about. And I found the person I've spent my life with. And, you know, in every way, as it were, I found myself. So Iran was great for me.
Dick Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can hear Dick Davis this weekend. He will be giving a lecture at the a Persian musical feast. The Carpe Diem String Quartet is presenting a Persian musical feast, a 3-day mini festival celebrating the culture. Learn more by going to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Once again, Dick Davis, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
somewhere. Let's meet the public.
You want to normalize it?
Yes, exactly. I want to meet some regular normals. Where are we going to find them?
On the next Fresh Air, Julia Louis-Dreyfus tells us about playing the Vice President of the United States in the new HBO series Veep. And we hear from the co-creator of the new Sherlock Holmes series on PBS, Stephen Moffat. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 83 degrees with sunshine today and a high of 87. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 64.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to support WOSU. More on leaving a legacy at 292-9678.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about Persia/Iran today. Same country, different names. This weekend, the Carpe Diem String Quartet presents a Persian musical feast, a three-day mini-festival celebrating the culture, literature, music, and food of the Persian people. We'll post a link for more information on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Joining us now is Richard Herman. He is chair of the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. We're going to talk about Iran today. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So where do we stand in terms of Iranian-Israeli politics, for one thing? Is the U.S. A middleman in all of this? There's a lot happening right now.
Right. I don't think the United States is a middleman. That's not the way I would think about it. The Iranian nuclear program, most Israeli leaders see as an existential threat, and they believe that they cannot allow Iran to go nuclear. They've tried to convey that in every way possible to the President of the United States, and he's heard them, at least he said so, and that they don't want us to get into the position where we would allow Iran to go nuclear and then try to contain it through deterrence the way we have with China and earlier the Soviet Union and even today with Russia. They want us to prevent them from having nuclear weapons. And the Israelis have made it fairly clear, if we won't, they will. And so I don't think we're really the middle person. What we think, best I can judge from what the administration says, is that a military attack is a bad idea. And a better idea is to try to talk Iran back from its nuclear program through a combination of very tough economic sanctions and some kind of light if they go the other way.
U.S. intelligence suggests that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons per se, but they have a lot of the components, and it would just be a matter of putting them together over the course of a very short period of time, 1 or 2 years, if they wanted to.
No, I think that they're further than that.
Okay, further away.
Yes,
okay.
I think that what the concern is that they're developing a competency in nuclear technology that's entirely legal, actually, under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think the problem is as much with the Non-Proliferation Treaty as it is these days with Iranian behavior, in that the treaty allows a lot of acquisition of nuclear capability in terms of the control and how to work with it and how to manufacture plutonium or uranium, enriched uranium. And then Iran could get to the mastery of those technologies and then sprint across the finish line when it decides to weaponize. It currently doesn't have the fuel. In other words, it's enriching uranium, and it would need to enrich a lot of uranium and to a very high level before it had enough fuel to create a bomb. And then also it would need a delivery vehicle of some kind. And I think on both those fronts, the generation of the fuel and the development of the delivery vehicle, never mind the trigger, they're a ways away still.
Just joining us, my guest is Rick Herman. He's chair of the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. We're talking about present-day Iran, the geopolitical implications that surround it. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Israel fears the underground spread of Iranian nuclear programs and the creation of an an impenetrable zone of immunity. Israel officials say the window of opportunity is closing, and in the U.S., we aren't so worried. What's this window of opportunity that's closing?
Israel thinks that at some point Iran will acquire enough fuel and secretly enrich uranium to a higher level than is allowed under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty would allow some enrichment. We think Iran is enriching to 5 or 20%. 20% is what's necessary for medical purposes. 5% is what's necessary for fuel, for energy production, and 90% is what's necessary for weapons. And so, but the way you would enrich uranium is just spin it longer and longer and longer in centrifuges. And the IAEA inspectors tell us they're not enriching beyond 5 or to 20%, but we're not confident because who knows how long those centrifuges are spinning.
That's something you can't see from a satellite,
it's
right?
It's difficult. And even on-site inspection, the Iranians over the last decade have had several sites that they haven't told us existed until we confronted them with our satellite observation that these centrifuges do exist. And then they said, oh, yeah, we just forgot to mention that to you. And so we're not confident we see everything, even through inspectors. Israel also knows that Iran has installed some air defense systems. Russia has been slow in making them active, but they are coming on and they're active now. So the cost of attack for the United States goes higher as we wait longer and longer. So I think also Israel's just nervous that we're getting closer and closer. In my view, have been trying to stop the program with cyber war in this Stuxnet virus that I believe Israel, probably the United States too, unleashed on some of the Iranian facilities. And they've done some other things, killing Iranian nuclear scientists, assassinating them in Tehran to slow the program down. But they're afraid at some point, and maybe not too far in the distant future, we'll get to where Iran could sprint across the finish line and have a nuclear weapon.
Would Israel prefer that Iran not have a nuclear program at all? In other words, not be able to delve into the nuclear medicine and all the other things that nuclear development means besides a bomb?
Probably. I mean, but Israel doesn't get to have whatever its preferences are. I suppose if you asked the prime minister of Israel, would you prefer that? He'd say, sure. That's not what they're demanding. What they're asking for is Iran not be allowed to enrich uranium. And it could have a civilian-oriented nuclear energy program, which is allowed under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And maybe the West, the United States or Russia, could provide the kind of fuel necessary to power those nuclear
plants. So they wouldn't have to have their own centrifuges and you wouldn't have to worry about
it. Right, and then we would take the spent fuel and recycle it probably to Turkey. In fact, Turkey and Brazil about a year and a half ago cooked up a deal where if Iran would, you know, compromise on the enrichment so that they couldn't produce their own fuel but buy it from Turkey or Russia, that they'd get it at very concessionary prices. That's been offered to Iran right from the beginning. But what Iran wants is to develop the capacity to manage all aspects of the nuclear cycle. And they say we won't go to the weaponized stage. But if you think about it as a football field, they'll march down 90 yards, and then they say we'll stop, we won't go the last 10, and Israel isn't willing to run that risk.
The P5 plus one, it's the five permanent members on the UN Security Council plus Germany.
Yes.
What role does it play in monitoring nuclear programs, and to what extent is it its existence related to the fears about Iran?
Well, the P5 plus one is not a monitoring organization.
Okay.
That's a negotiating group that's trying to show the Iranians that there's a united world front against them, that it's not just the United States that's complaining about their nuclear program, and it's not Israel that's complaining about their nuclear program. It's France, and it's the Europeans, and the Russians, and the Chinese, and everyone says that you have to stay within the boundaries of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we do not want you to weaponize. And so and Germany is also a key economic partner. That's why they've included Germany into the P5. Plus Germany, and trying to convey to Iran that you will pay a terrible economic price, a terrible diplomatic price of isolation put together by the P5 plus one. And therefore, you should concede and accommodate and allow the inspection arm of the treaty, which is the International Atomic Energy Agency, to be on site And now we get into some technical details. The IAEA is, in fact, inspecting in Iran. It wants even more intrusive rights to go without announcement, that it just shows up at your door and knocks on the laboratory and wants to see what's going on, or can go to sites that Iran currently says are military-sensitive sites and therefore you can't come in. But, of course, that leads us to think that's precisely where you're hiding everything.
If you would like to speak with Rick Herman, chair of the Department of Political Science at OSU, we're talking about Iran right now. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The United States, of course, has a long history of crummy relations, to put it lightly, with Iran. The 1979 hostage crisis is just one component of that. What effect does the past have on U.S.-Iranian relations today? What's its relationship today?
It's bad, and it's stayed bad in terms of my entire adult lifetime. In fact, just shortly after Dick Davis left Iran, he and I have spent all of our adult lifetimes watching an Iranian-American relationship that has been awful. And ironically, it would be positive on the human-to-human level. There are more than a million Iranians in Los Angeles. The relationship between the United States and the Iranians was close and for a long time. And I think today in Tehran, most Iranians like the United States, probably like it much more than they do their own regime. I think the regime's in support in Iran is pretty thin, but it controls all the elements of coercive power, and so it can stay in control. So I think the relationship is now moving on two levels. There's the official level, which I think the U.S. would prefer this regime in Iran eventually to change, in fact, sooner rather than later. I think the Iranians know that and think that our demanding on the nuclear program is just one demand. What we really would like to see is the regime change, and I think they're probably right. We would like to see that. A regime that wouldn't be as intensely anti-American and as intensely anti-Israeli and as determined to spread a particular form of Islamic belief around the Middle East, and one that would comply more with normal standards of international behavior.
Well, so in other words, something different than what we've been experiencing or what we've had to live with since 1979 or 1980.
And the Iranians have been very sensitive to the Western imperialism. They suffered under the British. We were involved in the 1950s in overthrowing a democratically elected parliamentarian. Our history on this side is not faultless by a long shot. And we supported the Shah, who was a very tough, brutal dictator. And we supported him for more than two decades. And Iranians my age know that. And it damaged our relationship with Iran very deeply. They know that we used Iran, so to speak, in the Cold War as a geostrategic pawn against the Soviet Union. And the people who paid the price for that in terms of the Shah's dictatorship were the Iranians. Now, most of them are 60 years old, and the new generation between 40 and 25 don't remember all of that, although they've been socialized and trained in it.
And I was wondering, what do they know of their past? What do they know of us? Now, with social media, with the internet, things have changed a lot, but have they been so indoctrinated that they don't really know what?
I don't think so. I'm sure there's some who have. Certainly people who have a vested interest in the survival of this regime. But I think most Iranians, certainly in Tehran, know. They're wired in, as you say. They have relatives in the United States. Many of them are pretty well educated. They are quite aware that the problems of Iran today have been caused by the leaders of Iran. And while their grandparents may have blamed the United States for the problems that the Shah produced, I don't think very many blame the United States for the problems that Khamenei and Ahmadinejad have produced. I think they blame Khamenei and Ahmadinejad. And that's one reason, ironically, that when we get to the Middle East, the one country where I think the street, so to speak, actually likes America is Iran. And when you're in the Arab world, where many of them still do blame us for Mubarak or for whomever, the kings in Saudi Arabia or the sheikh in Bahrain, they don't like us because we're kind of associated with the regimes that they are trying to overthrow and they don't like. In Iran, on the other hand, we're kind of now on the side of political change, political reform, democratization, which I think a lot of people in Iran do want.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi. My question is, if Iran did drop a nuclear weapon on the land of Israel. What effect would that have on the Palestinian people and the holy sites that they all hold so sacred?
Well, it would be very, very bad.
Probably destroy them.
Depending where the bomb went off and how big it was and all those things. But it would be a terrible outcome. I'm not convinced Iran would do that. The deterrence, I mean, Iran would be destroyed. I mean, Israel has a very capable nuclear force, much larger than anything Iran would have. We do as well. And if Iran launched a preemptive nuclear assault, I think Iran would face just devastating retaliation. I don't really think that, I mean, that may be the Israeli fear, sort of, but I don't think that's what's really motivating the regime. I don't think they believe Iran out of the blue would attack them with a nuclear weapon.
They just want the same kind of leverage and gunboat diplomacy, I guess, as anybody would.
They have an advantage now. They have it. Iran doesn't. And that allows Israel, at any time when they were in a war, to threaten escalation that you can't, that the adversary cannot match. If Iran could match that and say, well, if you attack our city, will attack yours, then you're kind of in a nuclear stalemate. And that might make it more safe for conventional war and terrorism and stuff to go on, with the Muslim side knowing that Israel's escalatory threat could be countered by Iran. And if it becomes that kind of war of attrition, Israel's in a very great disadvantage. It has a very small population compared to the very large Arab populations that are around it. And one of the things that's kept it secure all these years is it has the capacity to escalate. We call it escalation dominance is the jargon, in a way to threaten any Arab capital with total annihilation. And they cannot threaten Israel likewise. And that means at some point Israel can play that trump card and say, this war is going to end now, or you're going to end. And if Iran went nuclear, that card would be gone. And I think Israel is very reluctant to give up that trump card.
What about the social unrest from many months ago now? Is there any sense that that could percolate again?
Iran?
Yeah, in Iran, yes.
Yeah, in 2009, the Green Movement was very strong, and many people believe it won the election. And then Khamenei and Ahmadinejad decided that they wouldn't allow that transfer of power. I don't know. A lot of other people think maybe Ahmadinejad did win. No matter who did, the country was deeply split. That was obvious. Most of the leaders of the Green Movement have been arrested. Many of them are in jail for treason, some for life. The regime used a very heavy hand over the next 18 months to smash the leadership and their families of that movement. I really don't know. Now it's invisible. It's underground, and they're keeping their heads down. As I mentioned, many of the former leaders are in jail. I just don't know what kind of legs it has. I think if this regime became wobbly, and key members of the security force decided to defect, like we're seeing in Syria, then we might see coming out of the woodwork a lot of support for change again. But short of that, there's no crack in this regime right now, unlike in Syria.
Well, Rick Herman, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was good to be here.
Rick Herman, he's chair of the Department of Political Science at OSU. Once again, we've been talking about Iran today because the Carpe Diem String Quartet presents a Persian musical feast this weekend. For more information about that, go to WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.